Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It's time once again to present our favorite stories, including boxer Mickey Ward's climb from mere boxing champion to Hollywood inspiration, the quest to determine whether a long-lost 18th century portrait is the first ever depiction of baseball, a poet's attempt to capture the essence of Wimbledon, and comic book legend Stan Lee's stab at reforming the NHL. Also ahead, to bare feet or not to bare feet? That is the question, for some runners anyway.
There was one guy wearing shoes, and he said, "Don't worry, I'm a convert," as if to reassure us that even though he was wearing shoes, he was into this minimalist and barefooting thing. And I said, "Dude, we're not a cult."
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Fighter starred Mark Wahlberg, Amy Adams, Christian Bale, and Melissa Leo, and the latter two actors took home Academy Awards for their performances. Early in 2011, I had the opportunity to talk with a guy familiar with the script long before the Oscars were doled out.
Yeah, I mean, it was really good. It was really, I mean, obviously, you know, in a movie, they make things, they don't make things up, but they make things more dramatized and, you know, things like that. But I was happy with the way the movie came out.
Mickey Ward, film critic, winner of 38 professional bouts and loser of 13, is the guy upon whose life The Fighter is based. And boxing was only part of what made Ward's story attractive to Hollywood. His half-brother, Dickie Eklund, an ex-fighter himself and Mickey's sometime trainer, has struggled with drug addiction. He's been in and out of prison. Ward's mother managed much of his career, and his seven sisters by turns supported, distracted, and embarrassed the boxer as he tried to concentrate on his trade. At one dramatic moment in the film, Mickey, played by Mark Wahlberg, steps between the feuding camps of his girlfriend and his family.
He's a junk bag.
Why am I the problem? I'm his blood. I'm his family.
I'm the one fighting, okay? Not you, not you, and not you. I know what I need.
And you need Dickie?
I want Dickie back. And I want you, Charlene. And I want O'Keefe. I want my family. What's wrong with that?
Wahlberg is convincing as Mickey Ward, but Mickey himself feels that the folks who nominated Christian Bale for Best Supporting Actor based on his portrayal of Dickie Eklund knew what they were doing.
It could be, you know, it's just unfortunate that Mark played my character that's more laid back and, you know, more ain't as crazy as Dickie's, you know. And Mark, you know, I just feel bad that Mark didn't get to play that nutty guy, you know. But, I mean, it is what it is, but Christian, I'm telling you, he's a very nice person, and he's a great actor. He nailed it.
In one of Bale's more athletic scenes, he jumps from the second-story window of a crack house rather than get caught in the place by members of his family. I asked Mickey Ward if Dickie was okay with that scene.
Oh, yeah, he was great. He was good with it. It was funny when we first went out to L.A. to see it the first time. Me, Mark, and Christian. Me, Mark, and Dickie were sitting up in the back. Christian and his wife were in the front out in L.A. in that theater at Paramount Pictures, and we're looking at Dickie making faces when the people jumped out of the window. So I was, "Why, that didn't happen?" I says to him. He goes, "Yeah, it happened. But I went out the third floor, not the second. And there was no barrels underneath me." I was like, "Oh, wow." I go, "Okay. So you proud of that?" And he says, "No, I'm not."
According to Mickey, Dickie is currently, quote, doing okay. He's working with youngsters in the gym Mickey co-owns, staying sober, taking it one day at a time. Which is not to say Mickey is completely free of resentment regarding his half-brother. It was Dickie, after all, who fouled up the cameos director David Russell tried to give them in The Fighter.
Me and Dickie were, David O. Russell gave us like two paragraphs apiece to play. We're going to play a person on the street. And so it gives me my script and Dickie his script. So I look at it and I go, okay. So I got to go home and study it. Dickie looks at it and goes, "I wouldn't say this." David goes, "Dickie, it's not you. You're a person from the street of Lowell talking about yourself. You're not you." He goes, "I don't care. This person shouldn't say that." He goes, "Dickie, it's a movie." He goes, Dickie goes, well, this person is crazy. He shouldn't say that. It's not you, Dickie. You got to remember, Dickie, it's a person from the street. Dickie goes, I don't want to do it.
So that was that, and Dickie Eklund took his half-brother's acting career down with his own?
Yeah, it did. It did, but I'm a fighter, and I'm going to come back.
It is a good and even a great thing that Mickey Ward can laugh about Dickie's most recent act of sabotage. In the movie, Dickie is portrayed as a crafty but thoroughly undependable corner man, a guy who can't even be counted on to show up at the gym sober and on time. According to Bob Halloran, with whom I spoke in 2007 regarding his Mickey Ward biography, Irish Thunder, that portrayal is true to the relationship Mickey Ward tolerated for years.
I don't have any specific details of Dickie being messed up on drugs or something when he was in the corner, but Mickey did say there were times when he couldn't understand what Dickie was saying.
As he got to know Mickey Ward and became more aware of the volatile circumstances of his home life, Halloran developed tremendous respect for Ward's determination.
I don't know where Mickey gets his moral center. I really don't. It's not in his family. No offense to his family. It's not in the boxing community where there's so much, corruption and things like that. I don't think he's naive. I think he knows what goes on around him. One of the greatest things I can say about him is that he is just so focused on success and hard work. He'll just do the work. You guys can, do your business on the outside. You can steal the money. You can do whatever you want. I'm just working. I'm in the gym. And when it comes to the fight night, I'm going to be in the ring with that guy, and I'm going to do what I do. And I think he lets the chips fall to the side.
In The Fighter, Mark Wahlberg is convincing as the determined and ultimately triumphant Mickey Ward. But verisimilitude requires that Ward's sisters be portrayed as obstacles to the fighter's career, and loud, drunken, obnoxious obstacles at that. Before he saw the film, Ward said that he knew that if he was going to watch it in the company of his sisters, he'd better wear his boxing headgear. A bit of an exaggeration, as it turned out.
Well, okay. I mean, some liked it, some didn't like it. Some got up and walked out, some stood. Some threw some F-bombs around as they were walking out at me. Not really at me.
Did they blame you?
No. They didn't blame me at all. They didn't blame me whatsoever. They were just upset that the way they portrayed and, with the high hair and the craziness. I mean, they were crazy in their own way, but they didn't have high hair like that. That didn't make them look too good.
As Mickey puts it, there is still no love lost between his sisters and his wife, Charlene. But except for that unhappy circumstance, Mickey Ward seems to be doing pretty well for himself. His businesses include a tanning salon, an indoor floor hockey facility, and the aforementioned gym. Just a week before The Fighter netted two Oscars, Ward told me he was looking forward to attending the Academy Awards ceremony and that he figured The Fighter had at least an underdog's chance to be named Best Picture, which it was not. But he also admitted that even if it didn't win, the making of the movie and the attendant publicity had become important parts of his post-boxing life.
It's opened up a lot of different avenues as far as a lot of speaking stuff I do, some business stuff, things like that. People got to see what my background was a little bit in somewhat fashion, how things were in my life, to overcome, to get where I got. Because when people watched me fight, they didn't realize the things I was dealing with outside of the ring. And for people to see that, and for younger fighters or anybody in any sport life, to see you can go through turmoil and some family drama and stuff, and you can still make it. As long as you keep your heart and your mind in it, and you just believe in yourself, you can make it. And I think that's what it showed people.
Mickey Ward, now 46, last fought in 2003. His recent brush with the glitter and glamour of Hollywood notwithstanding, he continues to reside in Lowell, Massachusetts. How could Wimbledon, the world's most prestigious tennis tournament, get any tonier? Simple. Toss in a poet. That would be Matt Harvey, the 2010 tournament's official championships poet, who joined me in June of that year, and I asked him if I should address him as your poetship or my lord, the monger of verse.
You can feel free. I'll answer to pretty much most things that people say to me, but if you just stick with Matt for now, partly just to save time.
I'll do it then. Matt, are there any perks? Do you get robes or a scepter, perhaps a special hat?
You know what? I don't need robes. I don't need a scepter or a special hat. What I have is a very special laminated badge that gets me access pretty much all areas. People would die for this badge.
Yes.
So I can go anywhere except the players' dressing rooms. What it doesn't do, this is tragic, it doesn't get me just free access to centre court or the show courts whenever I would like. And that's because Wimbledon are saying to me, look, could you focus more on the background and the umpires and the ball boys and the queue and the strawberries and the Boston Ivy clambering up the side of the buildings? You're not a sports poet, Matt. They say you're not a sports journalist, poet. So I'm here to really write about the setting.
Perhaps you could read at least the first 14 lines of the poem titled Thwack.
Could I be perverse and read the last 14 lines?
You're the poet.
You know, this is a whole game. It's a whole game of tennis from level to game. We join it at 40-30. Bounce, 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 bounce. Thwack, 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 plock, thwackety blick, thwackety black, twoity, froity, froity, twoity, slowity, quickity, quickity, slowity, turnity, headity, headity, turnity. Seems like we've been here a blooming eternity. Rightity, leftity, rightity, toppity, spinity, backhandy, slicity, lookity, watchity, scratchity, botity, fabulous forehand, backhandy, slicity, furious forehand, savagely slicity, fearsome ferocity, vicious velocity, bilious backhand, blasted so blistery, half a mile out with that line judge's history. Out! Game. New balls, please.
Wonderful. It's just breathtaking.
I'd like to read you my Andy Murray poem.
Well, I was going to say, there is another poem that I'd like you to read called One of Ours.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll read you One of Ours. If ever he's brattish or brutish or skittish, he's Scottish. But if he looks fittish and his form is hottish, he's British.
That poem is referring to Andy Murray. Obviously, each time Wimbledon comes along, the English hope for somebody from England to win the men's side, the women's side, or both sides. Are you rooting for Murray?
I am, as it happens, yeah. I don't have many other people to root for, to be honest. And so, but I do like the guy, and I feel like, even though I don't really know him, I feel like I've got to know him. I've sort of watched him mature as a player and as a man, and so I would really like him to do very, very well and go all the way here. That would give me enormous pleasure, even though it would put great pressure on me to write perhaps a more solemn poem to celebrate it. But I'd be willing to make the effort.
Somebody told me that you had tried to rhyme Federer with et cetera, and I was a little dubious about that.
I think tried is the wrong word there. I think I actually did.
Ah.
No, I confessed that to a journalist that I was working on a little sonnet that might try and get away with that. And actually, I think that little sonnet's working quite well. I'm probably going to put it up on the blog later and hope no one notices.
Well, I'm sure people will notice and they'll be delighted by it, as they are sure to be by everything that you're producing. But there are challenges in this tournament. What do you do if Elena Dementieva ends up winning?
I put her name in the middle of the line.
I
repeat what I said at the very beginning of the tournament when I was first talking to people, saying, I'm really here to write about the grass and the strawberries and the umpires and the ball boys.
Of course, you could always go with Dementieva made a save too, didn't she?
Hey!
Do you get to name a successor because, well, check this out. His words are most lively, his syllables bounce right by other poets, whom he'd likely trounce if they had the tennis balls to take his measure. His verse is a bloody delight and a pleasure. Thank you, Matt Harvey, championships poet, for speaking with
me. Well, thank you, Bill. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Colorado has an official winter sport, and if you can't guess that it's skiing, you didn't try very hard. Now, Representative Tom Massey, Republican Colorado, thinks his state needs a seasonal alternative. He's sponsoring a resolution declaring Packboro racing the official summer sport of his state. This will no doubt delight Brad Wan, the spokesman for the Western Packboro Association, who said that donkey races are a tribute to the miners who used to race back to the office with their donkeys in order to stake claims on the land where they had struck gold. Lacking mines, today's competitors run alongside their donkeys, each of which carries a 33-pound pack and mining tools, which are superfluous and probably heavy. Hard to see how Representative Massey's campaign can fail. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Stan Lee wins his struggle with the nefarious Dr. Bettman and spawns a new race of NHL-themed superheroes. But first... Sometimes a story just comes together, and other times it's not so simple. For much of 2010, Only a Game's Doug Trabue tracked a sports mystery. Unfortunately, he hadn't cracked the case as of October. Still, the investigation did yield some interesting results.
It was a cold winter day. I was in my office, feet on my desk, scotch in my hand, hoping another case would come along. That's when she walked through my door. Okay, it was a little less dramatic than that. One morning in February, I got to work, sat down in front of my computer, opened an email, skimmed the text, and clicked on the attachment. An image appeared. Two boys, probably between the ages of 10 and 13 years old. One boy has dark skin, one light. They're both holding bats, and one boy's holding a ball. Just an ordinary sports scene. Except the boys are wearing long frocks and white dress shirts with broad, frilly collars, and the image is a black-and-white copy of an oil painting done more than 200 years ago. Mario Valdes is the man who sent the email, and he's been thinking about that image off and on for the past 35 years. Valdes is a freelance researcher based in Boston who focuses primarily on genealogy and African-American history projects. He first saw the double portrait in an issue of the art magazine Apollo.
Back in 1975, I stumbled on an advertisement by Bonhams for the sale of this painting, described as a piece by Ralph Earle. I was quite intrigued by it because one of the kids was black or Indian, I couldn't tell. But of course, that's what caught my attention.
Before I go any further, if you'd like to examine the portrait yourself, you can see it at onlyagame.org. The magazine ad lists the title as Double Portrait of Two Boys with Baseball Bats, but Valdes saw the painting as an unusual black history item. Over the years, he did some digging in his spare time, but it was three decades before Valdes realized the painting's potential significance in the world of sports. In 2004, research by historian John Thorne led to the discovery of a 1791 Pittsfield, Massachusetts bylaw containing the earliest written reference to baseball in North America. Valdes says when he heard the news, the portrait immediately came to mind.
And that's when I thought, my God, everyone's going ballistic over just this one little description, this one little mention of a baseball. And I'm sitting on what claims to be the earliest painting of baseball, if it indeed is baseball.
Valdes picked up his research again, starting with a call to Bonhams, the London auction house where it was sold. But the company had destroyed its records from that time. Valdes didn't give up. He spoke to baseball and cricket historians, contacted art experts, and even learned the boys' frilly collars most likely date the painting to the late 1700s. But while tidbits of information piled up, the painting's location was still a mystery. So when Valdes contacted me to see if I wanted to try to solve the case for a radio story, I began by talking with him at length. Then I started down some of the same roads he'd already followed and also went down several new ones.
Then, in 1927, he began hitting home runs at a pace close to his record-setting season of 1921.
In April, I made a trip to the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown, New York, to talk with senior curator Tom Schieber. Schieber says there aren't many objects children in an 18th century portrait could be holding that would really grab our attention in 2010.
What I think is so neat about this is that we're interested in it. That's what's neat about it, because it tells you that baseball means something to people, even to those who are not particularly interested in the sport. It's in our language. It's in the clothes we wear. It's in the advertising that is bombarded into your head every day. It's everywhere you look. You know, you talk about rose-colored glasses. We're wearing baseball-colored glasses here, and then so we're seeing baseball in this image.
It was reassuring that Schieber shared my enthusiasm, but his assessment of what the painting might tell us was less optimistic.
This particular painting, there's not a lot to grab onto. We don't have a good look at the objects that interest us, the ball and the bats. You know, it's possible that ball has some stitching on it. That might lend a clue. I just can't tell from this image. There's a background that's not helping me out right now, and maybe we could try and figure out where it is. I'm not even sure if we did how much that would help. So there's not a lot to go on here.
The best available clues are in the 1975 magazine ad, which lists Ralph Earle as the artist. Earle was a prolific portrait painter who was born in Massachusetts in 1751 and worked throughout the Northeast. He died in 1801. So at least that confirms it's an American painting, right? Not so fast. Earl was born in the American colonies, but was loyal to the crown. He fled to England in 1777 during the Revolution and didn't return until 1785. Beth Hise is a museum curator who lives in Sydney, Australia. She organized an exhibit titled Swinging Away, How Cricket and Baseball Connect, which is showing in London and coming to the Baseball Hall of Fame next year. Hise says 18th and 19th century English portraits of people holding cricket gear are relatively common, but if there was proof that Earl was painting American boys,
then the kind of equipment that they're holding would be the first clues that we would have of what bat and ball equipment looked like in the colonial American context, or the post-colonial American context. And so then this would be an extraordinarily significant painting. But if we don't know that, then it becomes an interesting painting that's potentially part of an English tradition.
The boys are dressed identically, in upper-class fashion. There's also a sense of closeness, with the dark-skinned boy resting his hand on the other's shoulder, a pose that often suggests the subjects are family members. Genealogical research eventually led Mario Valdes to theorize the boys were members of the Rogers family, a prominent Connecticut clan that had some interracial marriages.
The fact that there was this portrait, the fact that the way they're dressed, since Earl is painting in Connecticut, in the Connecticut area, and that's primarily his home base, it stands a good chance to be them.
But in a development I'm beginning to get used to, there's another complication. Despite the description in the 1975 ad, it's not certain that Ralph Earl was in fact the artist. After calls to the Smithsonian and other museums, I eventually found a curator who's an expert on Earl. Betsy Kornhauser of the Metropolitan Museum of Art was with the Wadsworth Athenaeum in Hartford, Connecticut when we spoke this spring. She told me without seeing the actual painting, she couldn't be certain it was Earl's work, and added that a number of portraits have been mistakenly credited to him. So I was back to staring at the ball and bats. And here's one fact I can confirm. Studying an image for clues is tricky business. When you see something incomplete, like a word missing letters, your mind automatically tries to fill in blanks. One boy's leaning on a bat, but we only see the handle. The other is holding his bat under his arm. We see both ends, but not the middle. I needed help, and I turned to David Block.
You know, I love stuff like this. I love historical mysteries, and I love, you know, stuff having to do with baseball.
Block is the author of Baseball Before We Knew It, and an expert on early bat and ball games that contributed to the evolution of baseball. He says the ball could have been used in a number of games, but the two bats are even tougher to pin down, and might even be different types.
The longer one appears to have a knob on the end that the fellow is resting his hand on, well, the one on the right is a one-handed bat, fairly thin, and if I were to speculate as to what that bat most likely would be used for from that era, I would say the game of trap ball.
But what about the title? Double Portrait of Two Boys with Baseball Bats. Nearly all of the historians I spoke with agree it's most likely a description written by the auctioneers. Unlike the ad, the earliest American references to baseball are almost always written as two words, and a different game by the same name in England was written as two words or separated with a hyphen. In other words, it's another dead end. Over the past 9 months, I've hit a lot of them and come up empty. It's been fun and frustrating. But I take comfort in the words of Baseball Hall of Fame senior curator Tom Schieber, who's done a lot more of this kind of work than I ever will.
To me, it's about the means. It's not necessarily about the end. So the research process, to me, is the most fun. If I can get something neat at the end, great. But it can't just be about the end, because a lot of times I don't get there.
So I'm throwing in my amateur historian towel and hanging up my research cleats. Until someone finds the actual painting, we might never know the full story of the boys and the game they played. And it's time to move on, unless I can get just one more clue. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
In hockey, it's useful to have a big, tough teammate who can help you settle the score when you've been wronged. But who backs up the big guy?
The most extraordinary superheroes ever assembled, the Guardians. Their powers know no equal. But are they enough to stop true evil?
Now they can turn to superheroes. The NHL unveiled the Guardian Project as part of the league's 2011 All-Star Game festivities in Raleigh, North Carolina. The project featured 30 new superheroes, one for each NHL team. And when you're looking to create new superheroes, you probably turn to Stan Lee, the man behind Spider-Man, the Hulk, the X-Men, and Iron Man, just to name a few. Stan Lee joined me in January of 2011, and I asked him how he became involved in the Guardian Project.
Well, it was brought to me. The suggestion came to me by some of the fellows who have been working on this for a long time. I thought it was a wonderful idea. It was such a big idea to create 30 superheroes, one representing each team. I had never done anything of that scope, of that scale. And yeah, it was a challenge, so away we went.
Well, the National Hockey League teams already have mascots, or at least most of them do. What are the benefits of having a superhero as well?
Well, a mascot is a mascot. But just by definition, a superhero is a superhero. And these superheroes are part of a team called the Guardians, which is really lucky for the Hockey League and for mankind in general.
I would think
because
so.
Because we now have new protectors. And in fact, to tell you what a good job they're doing, you remember when the president made his State of the Union speech?
Certainly.
There were no untoward incidents, were there?
Aha! Uh-huh.
The Guardians were on duty. But, of course, they are based on hockey teams, and each one of the heroes has a superpower mm-hmm. or a number of superpowers which have to do with the team he represents.
Well, some of these Guardians have already been revealed. Can you tell us, perhaps, which one is your favorite?
Oh, I have no favorites. I love them all. It's like asking a parent who's his favorite child. They are all so wonderful and so colorful and so exciting that whichever one I'm looking at the moment, that's my favorite.
One of the New York Rangers' powers is listed as, quote, narcoleptic confusion. And I'm very curious about what the Ranger can accomplish via narcoleptic confusion.
Well, if you can confuse your enemy, you're halfway toward victory right there, right?
Is hockey a favorite sport of yours?
I played hockey. See, I lived in New York, and there were very few ice rinks where I lived. So I used to play hockey in the street on roller skates with my friends, and we would have a guard at each end of the street to let us know if cars were coming. Mm-hmm. And if there were no cars coming, we hit that puck back and forth, and I loved it. But I've never played it on the ice, and I never played it when I got older, which is my loss.
You created some of the best-known comic book characters in history, Spider-Man, the X-Men, Iron Man, and others, and they all have special abilities, superhuman abilities. But which of your characters do you suppose would be the best athlete?
Well, I think Spider-Man would qualify because he is incredibly strong and nimble. I think Daredevil would qualify because even though he's blind, his other powers are so sharpened that he can do anything better than a sighted man. And if you could ever get the Hulk to calm down long enough, he might be pretty good.
Well, that would be the worry with the Hulk, that his temper would just get him in trouble with umpires and referees and officials every time, wouldn't it?
Yeah. If they drop the puck, he's apt to eat it. Hey, did you know I dropped the puck at a game here in L.A. a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah?
What a thrill that was. And then I rode around in the, what do you call that?
The Zamboni?
The Zamboni.
Zamboni, yeah. Terrific.
They wouldn't let me drive it, though, which kind of bothered me a little, but I was a passenger.
How did you originally get into the comic book business?
By accident, really. I heard there was an opening in this publishing house, which was owned by the husband of a cousin of mine, and due to that relationship, I heard there was an opening, so I applied for the job. I was only about 17 or 18, and I found out it was in the comic book department, because they also published other magazines, mm-hmm. and I stayed there for a while. I even changed my name. I used to have a real name, like Stanley Martin Lieber, you know, a real genuine name. But comic books in those, In those days, comic books had so little respect that I changed my name to Stan Lee. I just cut my first name in half because I didn't want to use my comic book name for when I wrote the great American novel, which I've still never gotten around to writing.
Oh, I hope there's plenty of time left for that.
Yeah, I'll get to it sooner or later.
Mr. Lee, just one last question. You're working with the National Hockey League in the development of these Guardians, and I'm wondering if after the league finals this spring, is there any chance that they will award the champions the Stan Lee Cup instead of the Stanley Cup? I mean, it would just mean a kind of minor spelling change.
Isn't that interesting? I hadn't thought of that. That would be very nice. And I'd be the guy who would give it, so I could go to the games and present it to people. You sound like a guy who has a lot of influence. So seeing you brought that up.
I was going to compliment you on your terrific judgment until that last thing.
Bless your heart.
Stan Lee is the creator of Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, the Hulk, and many more. His latest superheroes, The Guardian Project. Mr. Lee, thank you very, very much for speaking with me.
Oh, it was a pleasure talking to you. And just think, someday people will be saying, Stan Lee, the co-creator of the Guardians, as well as Spider-Man and the Hulk and the X-Men and the Iron Man.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
Monopoly is a relaxing way to spend a summer afternoon. That's what 9-year-old Kobe Jordan Anker and his 8-year-old brother Oliver were thinking as they attempted to bankrupt their grandmother on a recent afternoon on the deck of their vacation home in Bedford, New Hampshire. Suddenly, their mother, Lisa Jordan Anker, loudly urged them to come inside the house. She'd spotted a black bear entering the yard, perhaps to acquire whatever low-rent, light-blue property might still be available. Having learned there was nothing east of the waterworks except St. Charles Place, the bear tore a bird feeder down and ate the seeds. And then he consumed 4 small green houses and a little silver top hat. No, he didn't, just the seeds. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, runners who let their piggies out and love it. But first, the NASCAR Hall of Fame opened in 2010, so it'll be a long, long time before it inducts anyone who spent a majority of their career toiling on a pit crew. But it's the guys in the pits who make the difference, as North Carolina Public Radio's Dave DeWitt discovered when he attended the 2010 Pit Crew Challenge.
A typical NASCAR Sprint Cup race is won by just a few seconds or less. Like this year's Daytona 500, won by Jamie McMurray.
Crash at the back, never mind. Green flag still out. Checkered flag in the air. The 52nd Daytona 500 to Jamie McMurray.
Yes! Little Jamie, baby!
After the checkered flag, the scene is always the same. The winning driver cruises down victory lane, jumps on top of his car, drinks and sprays whatever beverage sponsors that car, and then it's awkward high fives and hugs with some other guys who are wearing similar jumpsuits. Those other guys, they're the pit crew, and they have titles that leave little doubt about their role. Rear tire changer, front tire carrier, jack man, gas man. The drivers, the ones who earn all the money and star in TV ads and get to kiss the pretty girls on the victory stand, they know who gets them to victory lane and what it takes to work in the pits. Here's driver Greg Biffle.
They have a very dangerous job. We're parallel parking at 55 miles an hour. I mean, I'm driving by people's feet that are 3 inches away, and they have got to be. They are a hell of an athlete to do what they are doing.
Some NASCAR naysayers may chuckle at the use of the word athlete when describing the guys on the pit crew, but that would be a mistake. About 75% of them played a sport in college. They're former linebackers or catchers or defensemen, and they're highly competitive.
Yeah, I'm Kurt Bowman, and I'm the gas man.
Kurt Bowman is a member of the pit crew for the number 31 Caterpillar Chevrolet, driven by Jeff Burton. He's an inverted mountain of a man, thin at the waist and broad at the shoulder, with a head like a flesh-colored melon. His dad took him to races as a kid, and when he left the military, he devoted his life to racing.
I mean, if you're not competitive, you're not going to survive in this business for a year, much less 20. I want to be the best at whatever I do, and it kills me if I'm not.
Bowman's been going over the wall at racetracks for 22 years. It's his full-time job, and he's invaluable to his team, says his pit crew coach, Matt Clark.
Oh, Kurt is the heartbeat, the heart and soul. He bleeds this pit crew deal. He bleeds the competition. He bleeds racing. I mean, he is honestly a model athlete for me.
There are only a couple of ways a pit crew member gets into the spotlight. One is bad, when he makes a mistake that loses a race, like what happened last week to Clint Bowyer's Jackman at Dover. Bowyer got back onto the track after a pit stop, and something came with him.
Bangs another car, and oh my goodness.
Hell, Jack's still on the car.
Yeah, says Mike Dillon, the spotter, and he will come back, have that removed, and serve a penalty.
Not a great day for the Jackman. But there's one night a year when he and the gas can catcher and the other guys on the pit crew get more positive attention.
All right, folks, let's meet the members of the number 88 Amp Energy National Guard team. The gas man is Chris Fasuka. The catch can, Aaron Walker.
The pit crew challenge is 7 years old, and it's NASCAR's answer to the dunk contest and home run derby. It draws the hardest of hardcore fans to Charlotte's downtown arena during the 2 weeks when the Sprint Cup Series parks in its de facto home base for Saturday's All-Star Race and next Sunday's Coca-Cola 600. The competition incorporates all the elements of a regular pit stop, with the added bonus of pushing a car 30 yards across a finish line. It's a wild 23 seconds.
Team's ready, set.
It looks chaotic, but a pit stop, whether it's during a race or in an arena, is choreographed to the tenth of a second. Kurt Bowman, the gas man, measures his steps like a football place kicker. One slip or misstep, and he's losing control of an 80-pound, 6-foot-tall gas can, as well as losing a race. The tire changers have a job that's just as tough, throwing themselves onto the ground around the car twice while carrying a high-speed air gun. One missed lug nut, and you're done, even in a made-for-TV event.
Looks like the 88 is clean with no penalties.
Kurt Bowman and the number 31 Caterpillar Chevy won the Pit Crew Challenge last year, and they were flawless in advancing into the finals of this year's tournament.
It's going to be the number 31 Caterpillar Chevrolet, the defending champs, trying to make it two in a row against last year's semifinalist, the number 11 FedEx Toyota.
The number 31 team falls behind early in the final. After the tires are changed and the gas is dumped in, they get to the push car a half a second after the FedEx team. A few seconds later, it's all over.
Congratulations! The number 11 FedEx Toyota team from Joe Gibbs Racing!
Exhausted and covered in sweat, Bowman sits down slowly on the pit wall as the other team celebrates.
And it stinks, you know. I hate to lose, we all do. But they're a good bunch of guys, and their gas man goes to the same barber I do. So me and him are pretty good buddies, so I'm happy for him anyway. Say, I hate losing.
In this event, losers get nothing, but each winning pit crew member earns $10,000. That's real money to these guys, who, when the races start up again this weekend, will return to anonymity. For Only a Game, I'm Dave DeWitt in Charlotte, North Carolina. On the road again.
In May of 2010, Only a Game's Karen Given kicked off her shoes and reported on a trend that excited members of the running world who love to let their tootsies wag in the breeze.
The recreational running craze took off in the 70s with the mantra, "All you need to run is a shirt, shorts, and a pair of shoes." But those shoes have become more and more complicated over the past few decades. A commercial for a popular sporting goods store reminds shoppers that May is National Running Month and poses the question.
You need anything?
Brooks Adrenaline, GTS!
Asics, Gel Kayano!
Modern running shoes generally cost between $80 and $200, but a movement is sweeping through the running community, suggesting that not only do we not need more and more expensive running shoes, we might not need shoes at all. Which is how, at 7 in the morning, 2 days before the Boston Marathon, while city workers erect barricades along the race route, a small revolution is taking place inside a downtown sporting goods store. Runners like Alice Jenny from Houston, Texas, slowed by foot and leg injuries, say they're no longer afraid to run barefoot.
No, I will do it in a heartbeat because I'm a runner and that's what I do. And I'm at the point where what I'm doing now isn't working for me. And so I've read about barefoot running and I started reading the book, Born to Run.
For the past year, Christopher McDougall, the author of Born to Run, has appeared on talk shows and crisscrossed the country for book signings, usually in his bare feet. Today, he plops those feet atop a bench in front of thousands of dollars worth of the best Nike, Adidas, and Saucony has to offer, preaching against wearing shoes.
ASICS now has a shoe which is responsive to women's menstrual cycles.
Yeah. Sounds like BS.
Doesn't it? You know, if you want to sell something, if you want to have the greatest marketing tool of all time, that's fear.
McDougall's fear came from something called cuboid syndrome. His doctors told him he's too tall, too broad, and too solid to run. Picture the guy who played the mummy in those Brendan Fraser movies. Now a few pounds lighter, McDougall still looks like he could fit Ethiopian distance runner Haile Gebrselassie in his back pocket. But he says he hasn't had a single running injury since he stopped wearing traditional running shoes. McDougall didn't invent barefoot running, but like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, he brought it to the masses.
Well, you know, we've hit a critical juncture where so many people have been hurt for so long that they're desperate, and what they've been told doesn't work. All of this crap on the wall doesn't do anything, doesn't help. They're obsessed because they want to be able to run around and not get hurt anymore.
Born to Run is the de facto Bible for a new generation of barefoot runners. But on the front cover, ultramarathoner Billy Barnett stands in silhouette, high atop a mountain in Mexico. And Billy is wearing shoes. Only a single chapter, just 16 of the 287-page tale of adventure, biology, physics, evolution, and ultramarathon history, actually addresses running shoes and why we might not need them. McDougall says he didn't know those 16 pages would fuel a movement.
No idea. Matter of fact, I almost cut that chapter about the shoes out of the book because when you start to get immersed in this kind of stuff, after a while, you just sort of take it for granted that everybody knows this. Because it's so logical and makes such perfect sense when you try it for yourself.
Corrado Giambalvo from Rome, Italy, is a product tester for Vibram Five Fingers, a company that produces a minimalist running shoe that looks like a cross between a slipper and a glove. He's run two marathons completely barefoot, and today he led a barefoot running clinic through Boston Common.
It's funny, we were running in the park, and there was one guy wearing shoes who was jogging with his girlfriend, I think, and he said, "Hey, don't worry, I'm a convert," as if to reassure us that even though he was wearing shoes, he was into this minimalist and barefooting thing. And I said, "Dude, we're not a cult. I mean, we're not trying to convert anybody, okay?"
But not everyone is convinced.
I'm just not buying it.
I'm simply not buying it for right now.
Kevin Kilbride is a marathoner from Santa Monica, California. He's in Boston to run the marathon, injured, but he's not swayed by Christopher McDougall's pitch.
I mean, it was a book. I picked up the book, and within three pages, I knew the bias. I knew what the bias was. I knew where he was going with it. And he's a damn good writer, and I'll finish the book, but I really think it's crap.
You're going to keep your shoes on.
Damn right, man.
Two days later, most marathon runners passing through the sleepy town of Newton are wearing shoes. Precious few wear minimalist running shoes or go completely barefoot. Robert Forster, a California physical therapist who's brought everyone from Jackie Joyner Kersee to Pete Sampras back from injury, points out that none of the winners are without shoes.
No. And I was at the New York Marathon this year. I was at the LA Marathon. I saw a handful of barefoot runners. And let me remind my colleagues in barefoot running that none of the elite Kenyans were barefoot in the races I saw. So presumably they switched from barefoot to shoes for a reason.
Barefoot running enthusiasts point to runners from Kenya's Rift Valley and a small tribe in Mexico's Copper Canyon as proof that people can run successfully for very long distances without shoes. But Forster says there's no reason those successes apply to you and me.
They need to remember that those folks have been running or walking barefoot since they were little kids. To take, first of all, a tenderfoot, if we can call it that, is, first of all, without the calluses, we're going to find, you know, problems with blisters and cuts and abrasions. Above and beyond that, I do think your skin will toughen up. But have the joints of your feet, which have been babied by wearing shoes for your whole life, you know, are they ready for the forces of barefoot running?
Forster says even with a proper running technique, modern running shoes are still needed for the most common running problem, overpronation. In the past 30 years, Forster says he's seen injuries decrease as running shoes get better and better. Dan Lieberman, professor of human evolutionary biology at Harvard University, says that's hogwash.
So far, nobody, myself included, has done an injury study. So nobody's ever done a study which shows that your shoes prevent you from getting injured. The flip side of that is nobody's ever done a study showing that not wearing shoes prevents you from getting injured either. So right now we're operating in an absence of information.
What Lieberman has studied and has been studying for years is how humans, about 2 million years ago, evolved to become the best long-distance runners in the mammalian world. Lieberman says we have features from our heads to our toes that are designed specifically for running. And some of those features seem to work best when we're barefoot. Lieberman says barefoot running is less impactful than the typical heel strike most of us do in shoes, and he says he can prove it.
This is the hardest treadmill in the world, which will prove to you that you can run on the hardest surfaces in the world with no impact.
Okay.
Let's see if you do it right. So Adam, why don't you get her up to a walking speed?
Lieberman strips me of my shoes and puts me on a treadmill fitted with a force plate and attached to a computer. Turns out, I'm a perfect test subject.
Every time her body hits the ground, she's making a loud noise, right? That's the collision of her body hitting the ground.
Lieberman shows me a graph of my short run. When my heel hits the ground, about 2 times my body weight slams back up my leg in just 1/10 of a second. Lieberman compares it to taking a hammer and hitting myself on the heel. No wonder I like my cushy-soled, pronation-correcting running shoes. A quick lesson in barefoot running technique, and I'm back on the treadmill.
Great job! See how much quieter that is?
Not only is it quieter, but this time the graph looks like rolling hills instead of large spikes. But Lieberman cautions, before I can become a true barefoot runner, I need to build up strength in my feet and my calves, and that needs to be done over time.
I would say don't do more than a mile at first. You know, if you decide to go run 5 miles tomorrow barefoot, you will curse the day you ever tried it, right? You'll be unhappy, you'll be in pain, you'll be in agony, you'll be limping around. It will not be fun.
The next day, I strap on my 5 fingers and set out on my first barefoot-style run. And I like it. Instead of hearing the slap-slap of my feet over the music in my iPod, I take the buds out of my ears and enjoy the sounds of the birds in the trees and the geese on the water. The only discomfort comes from a blister on my big toe. Maybe next time I go for a run, I'll put on my pronation-correcting shoes. Or maybe I'll go barefoot. Lieberman says the point of the barefoot movement isn't to tell people what they should or should not put on their feet. It's merely to tell us that we have the choice.
I think there's a general trend. I mean, you're going to see more and more minimal shoes out there in the market. And it doesn't mean you have to be like all this or all that. I mean, you can wear your high-heeled shoe on Tuesday, and you can wear your minimal shoe on Thursday, and you can go barefoot on Saturday. You can do what you want, and I think that's good for people.
If you'd like to share your barefoot running experience, or lack thereof, please visit us on Facebook at Only a Game Radio.
You can barefoot all night long. Take off your shoes and throw them away. Come back and get them another day. We're barefoot. Hey now.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen Given's barefoot running photo gallery and video, or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word comes from barefoot runner Dan Lieberman.
Yeah, I tell you, the worst thing out there is acorns in the fall. The only time I've actually injured myself is not needles or glass. It's acorns. They're dangerous.
Oh, gosh, I'm sure we'll soon hear from the nation's squirrels demanding equal time. And they run barefoot, too. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.